The city of Melitopol in the Zaporozhye region. It was taken by Russia in February last year. With no soldiers patrolling the streets, it doesn't feel like an occupied city, but there is an active insurgency targeting officials. While the Ukrainian counteroffensive falters 70 kilometers to the north, I meet with the Russian-appointed governor of the region in his underground bunker. Driving through the Zaporozhye region, it's clear the Russians were well prepared. Defensive lines, anti-tank dragon teeth, right throughout the region, even far to the south. The governor now has his sights set on the city of Zaporozhye, which is still under Ukrainian control. The streets are lined with Russian flags and billboards. This one says, "Russia is the country of opportunities. More opportunities for you." There are, without doubt, a lot more pro-Ukrainians here than in Donetsk. With the large pro-Russian population and those who just want peace, whether they live in Russia or Ukraine, the battle for hearts and minds in Zaporozhye will at least be far easier than for the Americans in Iraq. Meanwhile, thousands of Ukrainian soldiers are being sent to their deaths and billions of dollars spent in efforts to take back towns like this. Increasingly, questions are being asked, is it worth it? Jerry Miller, Zaporozhye.
Denouncing the act of blasphemy in the strongest terms. A group of protesters, including university students, gathered outside the Swedish embassy to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran by chanting slogans and carrying placards condemning the blasphemous move.
I've come here to say that the Holy Quran is very dear to us, and Sweden should not allow this amount of disrespect to our beliefs. This book should be respected because the names of other religious books like the Bible and the Torah are mentioned in it. Anyone who disrespects this book is also disrespecting Christians and Jews.
This level of blasphemy is totally unacceptable. We have come here to defend our beliefs, the Holy Quran and Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. My husband and my son have also joined me to send this message to the world. In Sweden, they have disrespected our holy book. No act of sacrilege can ever be considered acceptable.
The angry protesters also set the Swedish flag on fire. Meanwhile, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned Sweden's charge d'affaires in Tehran and has also called for an emergency meeting of the foreign ministers of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation.
The huge crowds that have gathered in front of the Swedish embassy in Tehran are also demanding the embassy to be closed down. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
After a long legal battle against the UK government's so-called Rwanda deportation plan, a welcome victory for rights campaigners and asylum seekers.
The result is that the High Court's decision that Rwanda was a safe third country is reversed, and that unless and until the deficiencies in its asylum processes are corrected, removal of asylum seekers to Rwanda will be unlawful.
It was a majority vote in the Royal Court of Appeal against a High Court decision in December last year that would have allowed the government to send asylum seekers arriving in the UK on small boats across the English Channel from France on a one-way trip to Rwanda, a plan slated by campaigners as immoral.
It's inhumane. They're treating people like they're not human beings. The reason why people are arriving on small boats in the UK is because they don't have safe passage. It's a deeply racist policy because it particularly impacts on communities that are already racialized, already face the most race discrimination in the world. And this challenge by the government needs to stop.
That is yet to happen. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who is grappling with high inflation, rising interest rates, and declining public support, has made this scheme one of his priorities. Reacting to the ruling, he said he disagreed with the court's decision and would do whatever necessary to make the deportations happen. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people entered the UK by crossing the Channel in 2022, a jump of more than 17,000 from the previous year's record. Many have since been held in detention.
It's awful. The conditions of detention centres in this country, in the UK, are worse than prison. So people are being held in horrific circumstances, in a situation that they have no control on, their lives essentially in limbo for long periods of time, and not knowing what's going to happen to them, whether they're just going to be put on a plane and deported at any moment. It's really demoralizing.
The Boris Johnson-era plan, fervently pursued by incumbent Interior Minister Suela Braverman, aims to deport asylum seekers to the East African country of Rwanda as part of a $148 million deal to deter asylum seekers.
The UK government still has the option of appealing this court's decision to the Supreme Court in what's already been a long legal process, delays that will continue to have an impact on some of the most vulnerable people who risk their lives to reach Britain. Said Purizab, London.
On Tuesday in the Italian capital, a string of left-leaning groups and anti-war associations organized a demonstration dubbed Stop Sending Weapons in protest against Italy's government's relentless support for Ukraine. Rome has so far approved 7 military support packages to Kyiv, including both lethal and non-lethal equipment, for over 1 billion euros. Italians have repeatedly expressed their opposition to sending weapons to Ukraine, but their calls have so far gone utterly unheard by successive governments.
We have a serious problem in Italy. The majority of the people are deeply against the war. All surveys have been showing that, and yet these people haven't been able to get together in an association or group. Everybody has to know that the government's decisions go against the will of the people.
I think everybody understood that this very war will not have a winner. Sending weapons will, the only effect will produce is longer war.
Italy's support to Ukraine hasn't only translated into sending military equipment. Last month, Italy's defense minister Guido Crosetto announced that Rome will deploy some 3,400 of its troops on NATO's eastern flank by the end of this year. Italy has been a staunch supporter of Ukraine since day one of the conflict with Russia. Recently, Italy's foreign minister Antonio Tajani has hinted at creating a NATO-Ukraine Council at the upcoming Atlantic Alliance's summit, which will be held in Lithuania next week.
Clearly, this proposal by the Italian minister Tajani only serves the purpose of extending the duration of the war, which is in contrast with the desire of the Italians. They want peace, and I find it very positive that Cardinal Matteo Zuppi is in Moscow for a 2-day peace mission.
The Holy See has sent the president of the Italian Bishops' Conference, Cardinal Matteo Maria Zuppi, as its envoy to Moscow to foster dialogue and seek a peaceful solution to the Russia-Ukraine war. The visit will end on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
Tehran has hosted an international conference on reviewing the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Iran's Vice President for Legal Affairs, Mohammad Dehghan, said that dozens of documents against U.S. sanctions have been prepared to counter such measures.
The U.S. administration used every illegitimate means to achieve its sinister goal and sought to destroy the Iranian government by putting pressure on the Iranian people. In the field of sanctions, a heavy case has been prepared against the U.S. Dozens of documents against these sanctions have been prepared, and every measure is taken to counter the sanctions against Iran.
Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize an issue, and this is exactly what the United States has done.
America's actions are not consistent with the commitments made in the 1948 Covenants and Declaration and other human rights documents. U.S. authorities have proven that wherever their legitimate interests and national interests require, they leave human rights documents aside, and whenever they want to oppress other governments, people, and societies, they act upon the claims of human rights violation.
The American Human Rights Week occasion in Iran marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, or the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran Islamic Republic Party. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast.
U.S. government tries to portray itself as a great savior for the world, which is really just a big lie or a great deception. Because we have seen, especially since September 11th, that the U.S. has killed many tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people, and has also made probably more than a million people, or maybe even more than 2 million people inside of the greater Middle East region. It's the U.S. government has made these people homeless.
People here say that the American version of human rights is a jab at Washington to question its dual take on human rights and to expose it to the world. The participants believe that terrorism and sanctions are the main pillars of the American version of human rights, in the absence of which the U.S. will not be able to continue its hegemony dominance and plots across the globe. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Taliban stepped up security measures in Kabul and other major cities during Eid al-Adha celebrations. They even shut down telecommunication services for hours and deployed their forces on the streets of Kabul. Afghan people also expressed their satisfaction with the security measures and urged the Taliban to maintain security for all.
Actually, this Eid was great. The people celebrated Eid in a peaceful and joyous environment. People held rituals and prayers with ease and without security incidents. As you know, previously people were afraid of the security situation and used to attend mosques with fear of bomb attacks.
The UN mission in Afghanistan released a report last week indicating that more than 1,000 civilians have been killed and nearly 2,700 others injured in Afghanistan since the Taliban takeover in 2021. Daesh Khorasan province, which is an affiliate of the Daesh terrorist group, has claimed responsibility for most of the assaults, especially those on the Shia Hazara community.
Unfortunately, a series of IED and suicide attacks continued in Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover. We witnessed attacks on major schools, mosques, and educational centers in different provinces. Most of these attacks came as part of the ongoing systematic massacre of Shia Hazaras. Unfortunately, no fundamental steps have been taken to address this catastrophe and the ongoing miseries of the people.
The Daesh terrorist group is seeking a foothold in Afghanistan after it was defeated in Iraq and Syria. Taliban officials claim Daesh is sponsored by the West, saying they are committed to securing Afghanistan and busting the terror group. During the 2 years of the Taliban's rise to power, insecurity has taken its toll on Afghan civilians. People here are calling on the Taliban and the international community to work together for a more peaceful and prosperous future for Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Palestinian children are once again under attack. This as the Israeli regime has initiated a violent operation on the Jenin refugee camp on Sunday night. All of this is taking place in an area where 14,000 people live in a space of less than a half of a square kilometer. And the regime attacked from drones, blowing up doors and sending thousands of soldiers into the camp in the dark and allowed them to shoot at will to create as much horror and havoc as it could. The violent raid continues now as at least 10 Palestinians have been killed. And the Western world continues to fail to condemn the Israeli regime for its atrocities and remain silent as human rights seem to be for some, but not for all. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. out of Vancouver, Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner, Solidarity Network. Out of Seattle, Alice Rothschild, historian and investigative journalist.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me on this program. Well, I'm going to start it off in Vancouver. And Charlotte, I mean, we've been witnessing an increase and more violent attacks on Jenin in general. However, last night, it's been like a full-fledged war that has been declared. Your take on what's going on and why?
We've seen a tremendous rise in Palestinian resistance, particularly in the West Bank, particularly in the north of the West Bank, including Jenin, in the past several years, especially following the May 2021 Battle of Saif al-Quds, or the Unity Intifada. And this rise in Palestinian resistance, in its organization, in its capacity to fight back, and its capacity to strike significant blows against the occupation, has meant that the occupation has lost its grip over these areas, and that these Palestinian areas are fighting on a daily basis to become liberated territory. And that is that possibility, that potential, is something that strikes incredible fear in the heart of the Zionist occupation, even though it is tremendously, massively armed with this tremendous military machine that is backed to the hilt by $4 billion a year in U.S. military aid and funding. And so this idea that Jenin cannot be controlled is something that the Zionist occupation, they want to end this resistance. They want to crush it. And of course, this comes hand in hand with the internal crisis of the Zionist state that it is facing on a daily basis, and the attempt to externalize that crisis by uniting all Zionist forces to attack Palestinian resistance. At the same time that there is this terrible attack, this a massacre with 10 Palestinian martyrs' lives taken by the occupation forces, with bulldozers, armored caterpillar bulldozers rampaging through the streets of Jenin, there is also a tremendous resistance and resilience that, despite everything, has not and will not be crushed. And it is clear that the Zionist occupation will not achieve its goals through these tactics of colonial violence. Hmm.
Well, Alice, your take, because you heard what Charlotte said. I mean, it does seem as if the regime is overwhelmed. I mean, they went in just firing and drones attack, bombs going off. And I mean, if we compare what the resistance fighters have, and of course, again, I reiterate, this is a residential area. These are families living there. And then the type of equipment that the regime has, it does seem that they are extremely, extremely fearful of resistance fighters and resistance in general coming out of Jenin. I don't know your assessment of it all, and what do you think that they will accomplish by occupying this area right now?
Well, you know, I first of all agree with everything that was just said, and I think that what we're seeing is what some people are calling the Gazification of the West Bank, where despite the fact that there's been a brutal occupation for decades, there's been rising settler pogroms, which the military, encourages and supports, while at the same time declaring that it's not consistent with Jewish values, which is pretty ludicrous. So we see this rising level of oppression, and there is absolutely no reason to think that the resistance is not going to respond to that. In terms of what Israel thinks it's going to accomplish, I think they're trying to make the West Bank into Gaza to really beat people down and make it really, really difficult to live there. And the thing that we see that's very striking right now is this sudden uptick in the drones and the attacks from the sky, which is reminiscent of both Gaza and the Second Intifada. And also we're seeing, ambulances and paramedics coming under fire and difficulties in treating the wounded. So it's a very reminiscent, repetitive kind of thing. I think that the Israelis have this fantasy that they can beat Palestinians into submission, and it has proven unsuccessful for seven decades.
Yeah, interesting point that you made, Alice. Charlotte, she said, trying to make Jenin, basically, the West Bank into Gaza. But at the same time, Charlotte, if that's the case, haven't they failed to begin with? Because Gaza is also a center of resistance in general. Yes, the people are suffering, but hasn't the people become more revolutionized and basically coming to the point that resistance is the only way? So aren't they really just shooting themselves in the foot?
I think that's very true. The tactic of siege and isolation and encirclement is certainly something that the occupation is using against the Palestinian people in Gaza, and it wants to use this against every Palestinian city and village and town. I mean, this includes small villages where the village is encircled by settlements. This is another form of siege. And so, yes, we see this kind of, encirclement and attack. But it's also, as you said, very important to remember that Gaza is very much a negative example for the occupation. They are not satisfied with the status quo in Gaza, because it is clear that the Zionist soldiers cannot set one foot on the ground in Gaza, or else they will meet an incredible response from the resistance, which is stronger and more unified than ever. And we saw that just 2 months ago. In the battle that took place in Gaza against assassination, against killing, against the ongoing imprisonment of Palestinian leaders. And so the idea of Jenin becoming Gaza is in some ways, in terms of siege and encirclement, something that the Zionist occupation is perpetuating. But in other ways, it's exactly what they're afraid of. And what they're afraid of in terms of Jenin becoming Gaza is becoming a center of resistance that is fundamentally secure in the hands of the resistance and cannot be breached and cannot be destroyed by the Zionist occupation forces, despite all of their military might and despite the backing that they receive from Washington, Berlin, Paris, and London, that they're not able to break the Palestinian people. And in fact, the resistance has grown tremendously strong in the past 18 years, despite all of the siege and despite all of the casualties and all of the hardship that the occupation has inflicted upon the Palestinian people in Gaza. The resistance is stronger than ever. And so in many ways, that's exactly an outcome that terrifies this regime of settler colonial occupation and colonial domination, because it shows that it's fundamentally impossible to maintain that regime of control, because despite 75 years of Nakba, there are also still 75 years of resistance, 75 years of liberation struggle. And Gaza shows today that no matter what kind of siege you impose upon the Palestinian people, that siege will be met with resistance, with organizing, and with a tremendous popular cradle of support for resistance, for fighting back, and for the liberation of Palestine, not only in Gaza, not only in Jenin, but from the river to the sea.
But Alice, at the end of the day, why do you think that Israel has wanted to increase the pressure, up the ante, against the Palestinians in general right now? Because obviously, with every action, there is going to be a reaction. And of course, we see the reactions from the Palestinian resistance. So what is the entity after at the end?
Well, I think this is a real example of the bankruptcy of the vision. You know, we have an increasingly right-wing, fascistic kind of government where the leadership really doesn't view Palestinians as human beings, and where their idea of, you know, foreign policy is repeatedly, quote, mowing the lawn, which is the expression they used in Gaza. So I don't think that this is a rational conversation. This is a conversation between fascistic settler colonial leaders who have no qualms about collective punishment and killing civilians and further destroying the infrastructure. And they're also using the fact that there's this fratricidal war between Hamas and Fatah, and that the Palestinian leadership is no longer in control of the resistance. So they're using that as an excuse to go in, but it is devoid of any long-term vision of something that's going to get better. Their idea is just to constantly beat people down and make them more miserable. And I haven't been able to find any more reasonable explanation. It's the flourishing of a settler colonial idea of military might and suppressing the indigenous population. And I think the long-term goal is that they want people to leave, but that doesn't seem to be happening.
Hmm. Well, Charlotte, I mean, this war on Jenin is really a war on children, as a refugee camp is densely packed. Where are the outcries from the international organizations fighting for the rights of children always? As Palestinian kids are exposed to war crimes, is it that Palestinian kids don't have the same rights or value as other kids?
Well, certainly Palestinian children have tremendous value and equal value to all other children, but it is certainly true that Palestinian children are not treated with equal rights and value to other children around the world, and particularly the children of the Imperial Court, and certainly the children of the Zionist Project. I mean, what we see is not only the extrajudicial killing of children on a regular basis, traumatization of children, but certainly through the systems of incarceration that are put into place. There are hundreds of Palestinian children locked up in Zionist occupation jails. There are children being jailed right now without charge or trial under administrative detention. When these children are taken from their homes, their homes are invaded in the middle of the night by heavily armed occupation forces who, in many cases, explode the door of the home off its hinges before rushing in, tearing the child away from their family members, throwing them in the back of a military jeep and subjecting them to harsh military interrogation, holding them in confinement. It's much more than just confinement. It's an entire mechanism of trauma that has been labeled the unchilding of Palestinians. We look at the case of Ahmed Mennasra, who's been imprisoned since he was a young boy and has suffered tremendously as a result. And the occupation continues to deny him release and continues to hold him in solitary confinement, despite the fact that that is an ongoing form of psychological torture against this young man. Just today, two of the martyrs whose lives were taken are Palestinian children. And this is, and of course, in Gaza, we saw the way in which Palestinian children, full of promise, life, and hope for the future, were treated as collateral damage. And I think one of the things that's so important is to keep in mind about the Palestinian resistance, because this is completely flipped around in Western media. It's portrayed as if Palestinians are putting their children at risk. No, the Palestinian resistance are fighting to defend their children and are fighting for a future where Palestinian children can actually live with dignity, with justice, with hope for the future, and without this tremendous amount of trauma that is visited upon them on a daily basis by this violent settler colonial occupation regime.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
some of the resistance is actually demanding that fighters capture Israeli soldiers in Jenin. I want to talk about that. And what does that do psychologically to that Israeli soldier in this refugee camp? Your take on that, Alice.
Well, I think that it must be an incredibly demoralizing experience for an Israeli soldier. But the way that the state reacts is that they will do everything to get that soldier back. So that soldier has more value than Palestinian children, than Palestinian civilians. And so it ups the ante, and it also demoralizes the state. So I think it's a tactic that is actually very powerful, because it fractures the idea that the Israeli military is, you know, supreme and will never lose anybody. It will never suffer the consequences of its behavior. So I think it can be framed in that way.
Okay. Well, Charlotte, in 2002, during the Israeli regime's Allied attack on Jenin, at least 23 Israeli soldiers were killed in 11 days. Now, the resistance is much more prepared than it was then. Already there are reports of two Israeli troops being killed. Has Israel miscalculated by entering the camp? Your assessment of that side of things?
Certainly, the Israeli occupation is going to be able to extract a cost in blood and violence and destruction against Palestinian civilians, against a people under occupation, struggling for their freedom and liberation on a daily basis. But both in the short term and in the long term, it is clear that this tactic is not going to succeed any more than it did in 2002. Not only in the immediate loss of soldiers, of personnel, of technology, in addition to the reports that you've mentioned, we've seen numerous drones shot out of the sky. We've seen multiple military vehicles destroyed and equipment destroyed, not only in that immediate cost, but also in the long-term cost, because with every member of the resistance that they attack, that they assassinate, that they execute, that they kidnap and imprison in colonial occupation jails, there are yet more members of the resistance stepping forward or taking up the mantle of resistance to achieve that future of freedom and to bring about a society and a world and a Palestine where no one ever has to live in fear again of occupation troops ramming their bulldozers and weaponry and tanks through the streets of Jenin, and where the residents of the Jenin refugee camp are free to return to their homes and villages and build their future in a liberated Palestine.
Well, Alice, the regime has admitted that its goal in this operation is targeting resistance infrastructure. However, the resistance has never been more united and is involved in reciprocal attacks. And, of course, we're looking at a whole new generation of resistance fighters. Where do you see this going? Not only are we talking about this current battle, but in general, what we're looking at as Israel continues to increase its violent techniques.
Well, if we sort of look back at history, Israel has done this with impunity for decades. So in my worst nightmare, the Israeli forces will continue to traumatize and destroy Palestinian life and increase the level of despair and increase the number of militants who have nothing left to lose because their lives have been so destroyed by the occupation. In my better dreams, the ways that Palestinians resist, not only militantly, but in all the other facets of their life and in literature and in politics, that this will lead to a better outcome. At this moment, there's no way I can predict. I have to believe that there can be a better outcome and that there can be a free Palestine and that we can get to a place where everybody's rights and humanity are fully represented and respected. We have a long way to go because the international community is completely unable and unwilling to hold Israel accountable. So until, for instance, organizations in the U.S. Are able to really pressure Congress and Congress is really able to listen and we can challenge the military-industrial complex and the billions of dollars that we send to Israel, and until the narrative changes, which it is changing, it's just changing at a snail's pace compared to the level of need. We really support all forms of resistance for Palestinians. It also comes at a huge price. And so the level of suicides, depression, hopelessness is way up. And that's very, very dangerous for people and for society. So it is incumbent on us in the international community to support the Palestinian struggle and also to put pressure on our own governments who are not doing their job and who do not recognize the humanity and dignity of Palestinians.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. We're out of time, but thanks for being with us. Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver, and Alice Rothschild, historian, investigative journalist out of Seattle. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب
In the limelight.
In France, after five nights of violent protests, an appeal for calm has been made from the grandmother of the 17-year-old teenager Nahel, killed last Tuesday during a police traffic stop in a Paris suburb. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The European broadcaster Euronews has covered this story and tells us more. Some 2,800 people have been arrested since 17-year-old Nahel was shot by a police officer last Tuesday. The incident has stirred up long simmering tensions between the police and young people in France who struggle with poverty, unemployment and racial discrimination. Hushed and visibly anguished, hundreds of mourners from France's Islamic community formed a solemn procession from a mosque to a hillside cemetery on Saturday, 1st of July, to bury a teenager whose killing by police has triggered days of rioting and looting across the nation. Underscoring the gravity of the crisis, French President Emmanuel Macron scrapped an official trip to Germany after nights of unrest across France. The government deployed 45,000 police officers to city streets across the nation to head off a fifth night of violence. Overnight, France's Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin tweeted the night had been calmer than previous ones thanks to the resolute action of security forces. He put the night's arrest toll at 427. Gérald Darmanin tweeted late on Saturday that 200 riot police had been mobilized in the port city of Marseille, where television stations showed footage of police using tear gas as night fell. Near the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, hundreds of police officers with batons and shields stood restlessly along the Champs-Élysées, several in front of the shuttered Cartier boutique. Posts on social media had called for protests on the Grand Boulevard, but the police presence appeared to discourage any large gatherings in Champs-Élysées. Earlier in the day, at a hilltop cemetery in Nanterre, the Paris suburb where the teenager identified only as Nahel was killed, hundreds stood along the road to pay tribute as mourners carried his white casket from a mosque to the burial site. Journalists were barred from the funeral ceremony and in some cases even chased away. Some of the men carried folded prayer rugs. Men first, an official told dozens of women waiting to enter the cemetery. But Nahel's mother, dressed in white, walked inside to applause and headed towards the grave. Many of the men present in the cemetery were young, and they had come to mourn a boy who could have been them. Inside the cemetery gate, the casket was lifted above the crowd and carried towards the grave. The men followed, some holding little boys by the hand. As they left, some wiped their eyes. French police were nowhere to be seen. The unrest has been taking a toll on Emmanuel Macron's diplomatic profile. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier's office said President Macron phoned on Saturday, 1st of July, to request a postponement of what would have been the first state visit by a French president to Germany in 23 years. Emmanuel Macron's office said he spoke with Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and given the internal security situation, President Macron said he wished to stay in France over the coming days. Nahel was shot during a traffic stop. A video showed two police officers at the window of the car, one with his gun pointed at the driver. As the teenager pulled forward, the officer fired once through the windshield. This week, Nahel's mother said that she was angry at the police officer who shot her son, but not at the police in general. "He saw a little Arab-looking kid he wanted to take his life," she said. Nahel's family has its roots in Algeria. Race was a taboo topic for decades in France, which is officially committed to a doctrine of colorblind universalism. Critics say the doctrine has masked generations of systemic racism in France. The officer accused of killing Nahel was given a preliminary charge of voluntary homicide, meaning that investigating magistrates strongly suspect wrongdoing, but need to investigate more before sending a case to trial. Nanterre prosecutor Pascal Prash said his initial investigation led him to conclude that the police officer's use of his weapon wasn't legally justified. Hundreds of police and firefighters have been injured in the violence that erupted after the killing of Nahel. Authorities haven't released injury tallies for protesters. In French Guiana, an overseas territory, a 54-year-old person died after being hit by a stray bullet. The reaction to the killing was a potent reminder of the persistent poverty, discrimination, unemployment, and other lack of opportunity in neighborhoods around France, where many residents trace their roots to former French colonies, like where the 17-year-old teenager Nahel grew up. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. President Emmanuel Macron met the leaders of both houses of French Parliament on Monday, 3rd of July, as violent protests over the police shooting of teenager Nahel M appeared to ease after 5 nights of unrest that have seen thousands arrested and widespread destruction. Police made 49 arrests nationwide on Sunday, 2nd of July. French media reported, citing the Interior Ministry, down significantly from 719 arrests the day before and 1,300 arrests on Friday. French President Emmanuel Macron will also meet on Tuesday with mayors of 220 French towns and cities affected by the protests, Macron's office has confirmed. A crisis meeting on Sunday night has taken place with government ministers. The ebbing violence follows an appeal for calm from the grandmother of the 17-year-old teenager Nahel, killed last Tuesday during a police traffic stop in a Paris suburb. "Stop rioting and stop destroying," the grandmother, named as Nadia, told BFM TV. "I say this to those who are rioting. Do not smash windows, attack schools and buses. Stop. It's mothers who take those buses." The rioters, mostly children and young people, were using Nahel as an excuse, she said. "We want things to calm down." Her grandson, identified by only his first name, was buried on Saturday, 1st of July. On Sunday, politicians condemned an attack on Saturday night in which rioters rammed a burning car into the home of Vincent Jean Brun, the mayor of Les Roses. About 15 kilometres south of Paris at about 1:30 a.m., while his family were asleep. Vincent Jean Brun was at the town hall at the time, but his wife and one of his two young children, aged 5 and 7, were injured as they fled. Jean Brun's wife suffered a broken leg. "Last night was a new milestone in horror and disgrace," the mayor from the conservative Les Républicains party tweeted, condemning an act of unspeakable cowardice. Regional prosecutor Stéphane Hardouin opened an attempted murder investigation on Sunday, telling French television that a preliminary investigation suggested the car was meant to ram the house and set it ablaze. First indications suggest the car was driven into the building in order to set it on fire, Stéphane Hardouin said, adding that a Coca-Cola bottle filled with flammable liquid had also been found at the site. Visiting Les Roses on Sunday, Elizabeth Borne, the French Prime Minister, denounced an intolerable attack and pledged those responsible would not get away with it. While the situation was much calmer overall, the attack was particularly shocking, she said. Protesters also entered the garden of another mayor, in La Riche, outside the city of Tours, and tried to set alight his car, prosecutors said. Politicians of all parties expressed outrage at the attacks, with demonstrations of support planned outside town halls across France. More than 3,000 people have been detained since last Tuesday, after a mass deployment of 45,000 police officers around France. Over the weekend, Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said the deployment would be unchanged after protesters torched cars, looted shops, damaged infrastructure and clashed with police officers on Saturday night. The Paris police chief said it was too early to say the unrest had been quashed. there was evidently less damage, but we will still remain mobilized in the coming days, and nobody is claiming victory, Laurent Nunez said. The organizers of Tour de France cycling race, which started in Bilbao, Spain on Saturday 1st of July, are monitoring the situation in France very carefully. The event crossed into France on Monday, 3rd of July.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.